yay, oh yay, oh yay. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court. Be seated, please. Case number 08-1016 et al. National Cable and Telecommunications Association Petitioner versus Federal Communications Commission et al. Mr. Smith for Petitioner, National Cable and Telecommunications Association. Mr. Ames for Petitioner, National Multi-Housing Council et al. Mr. Marcus for Respondents, FCC et al. Mr. McBride for Interveners, AT&T Inc. et al.
May it please the court.
Morning.
Morning, Your Honor. I'm Paul Smith, representing the NCTA. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. My plan this morning is to address the reasons why there was no statutory authority for the FCC's order prohibiting and abrogating exclusive access arrangements between cable operators and owners of multiple dwelling unit buildings. I also hope, time permitting, to address the retroactivity issue, the question of whether or not there was it was arbitrary and capricious to abrogate existing agreements. Mr. Ames, counsel for the remaining petitioners, will address the reasons why we think that the FCC rule was arbitrary and capricious as overall. So let me start with the statutory issue. Section 628 of the Communications Act was clearly passed back in 1992 to address a specific problem, limits on competitors' access to cable programming that had arisen as a result of the vertical integration of cable operators with programming development companies. With the new DBS satellite services coming online back in 1992, Congress sought to assure that there would be that they, the DBS competitors, would be able to provide customers and subscribers with the same high-quality programming that had become popular on cable services. Now it's 15 years later, and the FCC has decided to try to transform Section 628 into its own version of Section 5 of the FTC Act, a provision that gives it the broad authority to regulate any aspect of cable competition or business practices that it deems unfair. This is, I submit, a classic example of an agency deciding it wanted to do something and then combing through the code to try to find some language that it could use to justify that.
It doesn't seem that kind of a strong statement, given that the language seems to cover what they're asking for, and that you're making an argument that it wasn't really intended to cover that. That is, aren't these acts or practices the effect of which is to prevent a multi-channel video programming distributor, in this case, for example, Verizon or something like that, from providing satellite cable programming to consumers? Doesn't it follow those words?
Your Honor, the ultimate issue is the intent of Congress.
No, I understand that, but I'm reacting to your original statement that they were combing through looking for something that they could attach a meaning to that doesn't follow the words. So my first question is, if on a purely textual basis, doesn't this rule come within the pure wording of this statement?
You can get there, Your Honor, if you read the words literally and without regard to the things that we usually do to try to ascertain what a sentence was intended to mean.
Okay, so you would concede that literally what they want to do comes within the words of the statute.
Literally, if you can't serve a building, then you can't deliver satellite
right.
cable
that's
programming
right.
and satellite broadcast programming. But the question that they have to answer in trying to convince you that that's what Congress intended to authorize is why.
Well, wait a minute. Why do they have to convince us that Congress intended to authorize that if the language covers it?
Well, Your Honor,
is your argument basically a Holy Trinity argument that the language of the statute should be ignored because there's an underlying purpose that's inconsistent with the statute?
No, Your Honor, my argument is
that's the most infamous case the Supreme Court's ever decided.
Yeah. My argument, Your Honor, is that you apply all the tools of statutory construction, including a fair examination of the language, which I think strongly supports our interpretation, and when you do that, you come to the conclusion that Congress directly addressed this question, had a specific intent to authorize one particular kind of regulation and not any others. And the problem with their language argument is that the focus on these two particular categories of programming, not all programming on cable, but two categories.
Well, what percentage of programming is encompassed by these two categories?
I don't think there's a percentage that I can give you, Your Honor, but it is a majority according to the commission, but not by any means all.
Is it a substantial majority?
Well, it doesn't include local broadcast television, which is something that people watch a great deal. So
except for that, is it everything except for local broadcast?
I'm informed that there are some categories that are now delivered by fiber that probably wasn't true in 1992, but it's true now for regional kinds of networks and things like that.
Is it relevant? how much percentage of the programming falls outside of either satellite or satellite broadcast?
Well, not according to the logic of the FCC's argument. If this statute just said anything that hinders your delivering Spanish language programming at 8 o'clock in the morning, their logic would still be the same.
That's why I asked the question. I asked the question just because of that very hypothetical you used in your brief. This is very different from that. I mean, this doesn't have anything to do with the interpretation of the statute, but the difference between this case and your Spanish language case is that here, as I understand it, satellite cable and satellite broadcast programming encompasses most of the programming we're talking about, whereas that's not the case in your Spanish language case.
Well, it is a different percentage, Your Honor, but the logic is the same, and it happens to be the two categories of program as to which there was a problem in 1992, that the cable operators were able, with vertical integration, to begin to lock up the programming. So there's a reason why they focused on those two categories, and that reason tells you that that's what Congress intended to focus on, not anything
else. Suppose
the
language had simply said programming without referring to satellite cable or satellite broadcast.
I think you'd have a very different case, Your Honor.
I think they
would have a much stronger argument that Congress is intending to create an FTC Act kind of regulation.
So then that gives away, if you concede that gives away your argument that there's a big distinction between programming and service.
Well, not necessarily, Your Honor. I mean, you could still read it that way. And one of the things you'd want to take into account is the fact that there's this long tradition of three levels of regulation, local, state, and federal, where each level's jobs are very specifically set out in the legislation by Congress. It would be very odd in that situation, absent a very strong indication of intent, to think that Congress intended to overturn that and give the FCC this broad preemptive authority without telling anybody about it at the time.
Isn't it fair to say that if it just said programming and didn't say satellite cable or satellite broadcast, you agree the government's case would prevail?
I don't agree that it would prevail, Your Honor. I think you could still argue that I said it would be stronger, I believe. but I think it would be hard. They'd still have to deal with the fact that it was a focus on programming and not service.
What is program? Doesn't programming just mean, isn't that a bureaucratic way of saying programs?
I don't know if it's bureaucratic, but
it's it's an odd way, a less concise way of simply saying programs. Prevent the provision of programs to consumers, television programs, video programs.
Right.
And it means the same thing, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. And that was what the problem was. There were certain programs like HBO that some cable companies owned, and they didn't want DBS to put them on there, and so that was the concern that Congress had, and all the.
I'm just trying to follow up with Judge Silberman's question. If it just said programming, then when you say you wouldn't completely lose, but it just make your case harder, why wouldn't you completely lose?
Because you'd still have the fact that Congress would have stuck this broad regulatory authority in subsection B of a section that's entirely concerned with access to Pacific programming brought about by vertical integration. It's conceded that that's what the rest of the section.
I don't think it is conceded that. But then you're asking us to look at the entire statute and to not take the literal meaning of Part B then.
Well, I'm asking you to read it with some common sense, as this court has repeatedly said.
Oh, that's too much.
And you know, there's the old elephant in a mouse hole dictum that comes up all the time in this case. Would they really have done this in subsection B of a programming section, a thing about vertical integration?
No, I think it's a very fair point that you argue. In fact, the government concedes that Congress had a specific intent to deal with the Ted Turner situation, and that's why the language is as it is. But nevertheless, the language certainly fits the government's rule, number one. And number two, although you have legislative history that indicates the core notion that animated Congress, you have no legislative history that indicates that the government's position is precluded.
I don't know if I agree with that, Your Honor. You have Mr. Tozan saying repeatedly, this legislation, pure and simple, does this one thing. Now, he doesn't go on to say, and by the way, 15 years from now, nobody should think it does anything else, including broad regulatory.
Suppose the government was very concerned about the importation of bananas, and it passed a statute giving an agency authority to preclude the import of fruit. But the whole legislative history dealt with the problem of bananas.
Well,
would you then say the government agency, and relevant one, didn't have authority to preclude the importation of pineapple?
Certainly not, Your Honor. But, you know, when you have a provision that specifically refers to two categories of programming, and not all programming, it is exceedingly odd to suggest that Congress intended to have be authorizing rules dealing with access to subscribers in their homes, and that it was, in fact, intending this broad regulatory authority.
Let me just read you this one sentence from the Commission's decision, okay? It says, on this point, it says anti-competitive practices can hinder or prevent MVPDs from providing programming to consumers, either by blocking their access to programming or by blocking their access to consumers. Isn't that exactly right?
Well, I think that's the same point that I was making at the beginning in response to Judge Garland, Your Honor. You can get there by saying step by step through the language of the statute. It, in fact, has an effect on access to this subcategory of programming. But I submit a serious effort to try to actually figure out what Congress had in mind wouldn't get you there, and that's what this court needs to do.
Wouldn't it be, when you use a phrase like exceedingly unusual, isn't it exceedingly unusual to tack on to subscribers or consumers at the end of this sentence if what you're really talking about is preventing to vendors or to distributors?
No, Your Honor, it's perfectly consistent with our reading, and since it's the primary meaning of the statute, even the FCC says that, to deal with wholesale access to programming.
If the statute, for instance, your argument, if the statute specifically directed itself to wholesale transactions, it could still say for the benefit of consumers and subscribers.
Right. Well, that's exactly what they did.
I totally agree that fits with the benefit language, but we're talking about providing satellite cable programming or satellite broadcast programming to subscribers or consumers. That's the end product, but that's, according to you, that's not what the purpose was. The purpose was to prevent limitations on access to distributors.
But even the FCC says that's the primary purpose. This language can't be inconsistent with that primary purpose.
Not inconsistent, but you're telling me what would be the best way for Congress to have worded if they wanted to do what the FCC said. If they wanted to do what you said, wouldn't the best way not be to not use words like consumers at the end of this, which is sort of general purpose language rather than specific implementation language?
Well, you could. I don't find that a particularly persuasive argument. I hope you won't either, Your Honor. It seems to me it's just a classic example of Congress focusing on the ultimate beneficiaries rather than on the thing they were regulating. But it's perfectly clear that what they were worried about primarily was that these DBS companies wouldn't be able to give these programs to their customers and therefore wouldn't get customers. That was the problem.
You know, the problem with your argument is the word primarily.
Well,
it's true. That was what they were primarily concerned about. That doesn't get you there, though, does it?
Well, Your Honor, I think it does get you there if you try to take into account all of the other indicia of what Congress would have meant in this situation. And this is very much like the American Bar Association versus FTC case, where you could get to some interpretation that lawyers and law firms were financial institutions subject to regulation. There was nothing wrong with the logic of that argument, but when you got to the end of it, it was completely implausible as an interpretation of what Congress intended to authorize. And I think this is exactly like that case. Does anybody really think that back in 1992 that they intended to create a little FTC act for the FCC to regulate everything that cable was doing?
It's not about regulating everything. It's quite specific. It's about hindering or preventing the provision of this kind of programming. That's not a little FTC act.
You would just have
something that says, if you want a little FTC act, you'd say unfair methods of competition or unfair practices relating to programming. That would be quite different. That would be a little FTC act.
But their argument is that's exactly what this is, that the fact that it has to do with delivery of this particular subcategory of programming has no effect, that any unfair method of competition that interferes with a competitor's being able to operate and therefore get subscribers will have that effect and therefore will be subject to regulation.
What about the purpose, including the spurring the development of communication technologies?
Yes, Your Honor. That whole purpose
discussion. That's pretty broad, isn't it?
Well, it is in some ways, but it's a reference to this new satellite technology that was coming along. If you read that whole sentence, it's all about satellite.
Well, there's a comma, and then there's an end to spur the development of communications technology.
Right, Your Honor. And what Congress was looking at is alternative ways to get programming into the home, and that situation, it was satellite, and that's what they were looking for, and they wanted to make sure that anybody who found a different way to get it there would have access to all the programs and be able to sell their service. And that's what this statute was all about.
Were you going to say something about retroactivity?
Thank you, Your Honor. Assuming that there...
Can you start by telling us how this case is any different from our decision in Sinclair Broadcasting?
Your Honor, I think it is different in that in this case, the contract is not going to be completely abrogated. It's only going to be abrogated as to one side, and we're going to be left with all the burdens of the contract and not the consideration. But even if it's not directly retroactive, I think it is not primarily retroactive. It's certainly secondarily retroactive. And as to that issue, the FCC, under the Yakima test, has an obligation to weigh the harms and benefits of abrogating obligations after the fact that have been created by contract. And this court has an obligation to examine critically whether that weighing was done rationally and it makes sense. And here, the FCC didn't do such a weighing.
Well,
it simply
did. It spent at least three pages in its decision analyzing the costs and benefits of it, and then balancing them against each other.
Well, the costs and benefits it weighed, Your Honor.
You don't like the result it reached, but you can't say it didn't do it.
No. There's two different things. There's the costs and benefits of the ability to enter into these agreements prospectively, which they did weigh, we think, incorrectly. But then when the question came, what do we do about existing agreements, they said they didn't weigh anything. They didn't talk about the defeating of reasonable investment bank expectations and how harmful that would be compared to the benefit. They simply said there isn't any justifiable reliance at all. People should have known that these things were going to get abrogated. They took the risk, and that's all they said. And that's just not fair. That's not right, given that they had a seven-year proceeding that ended just 4 years earlier and decided not to regulate in this area.
Right, and the commission decided at that point that there wasn't sufficient evidence at that point, not that they wouldn't ever regulate.
Well, that's true, Your Honor, but, you know, when they have a record that says we don't have sufficient evidence, there's benefits and burdens, looks like competition is increasing, and then 4 years later, competition is that much more increasing, how is anybody supposed to be on notice that there's going to be suddenly regulation? Particularly when, for that 7 years, one of the issues they were looking at is whether they had any statutory authority to do this. They never suggested 628 or anything else, and never answered that question at the end of the day in 2003. So we had both the absence of a statutory authority that anybody identified and the fact that they decided not to regulate.
So any good lawyer looking at that would have concluded that it's up in the air as to whether or not the FCC will assert authority under 628.
Well, they had never actually mentioned 628, Your Honor, so it never occurred to anybody.
That was a brooding omnipresence, wasn't it? Isn't it fair to say that any good lawyer would have looked at that and said it's up in the air?
Your Honor, I don't think so, because it never occurred to the FCC to use this statute for this purpose for 15 years. I don't know how the rest of the bar could be expected to understand the code more than the FCC itself. This was a bolt out of the blue, Your Honor. And so, the notion that there were no expectations that were defeated here just isn't an accurate case.
I understand. The FCC pointed out that a number of contracts entered into post-2003 had severability clauses.
Yes, Your Honor.
So obviously somebody thought about this as a brooding omnipresence.
As any lawyer worth his salt puts a severability clause into a lot of contracts, it doesn't mean that people were anticipating this.
This was severability specifically of this problem, wasn't it?
Well, I don't think so, Your Honor. I think they're just general severability clauses.
There was
state regulation in this area.
The order seemed to suggest that it was severability of this particular clause.
I don't recall that. I may be wrong, Your Honor.
I have two questions.
Okay.
How do you on your argument about what the primary evil that they were trying to get at here, how do you distinguish the Ancale case? There the court says Title VII was clearly not intended when it was passed to deal with same-sex discrimination. But the Supreme Court says, Justice Scalia, that's tough. You know, the words cover it, and that's it. Statutory prohibitions often go beyond the principal evil to cover reasonably comparable evils and is ultimately the provisions of our laws rather than the principal concerns of our legislatures by which we are governed. Why isn't that exactly the issue here? That is, it is specifically covered by the language. Maybe it wasn't the primary intention. But nonetheless, the Supreme Court's told us we have to follow the words.
Your Honor, it is different, I think. That might be the analogy in a situation like the one Judge Silberman suggested if they just said programming. But given that they referred to a subset of programming, you have a textual indication of a more limited intent there that wasn't present in Oncali. Just in Oncali, they simply hadn't anticipated same-sex harassment when they passed the statute, but it fit the words. Here, because it was basically harassment based on gender, here you have a specific textual indication that what is admitted to be their primary concern was their specific concern.
What is the specific textual indication?
The fact that they specifically refer to only two categories of programming that as to which the protection applied.
But those were the principal categories of programming.
Well, they were. I don't know that that's true, Your Honor. There was broadcast programming, the local stuff, which is what cable started out to deliver, was not covered by these categories. When you watch Channel 7 News in the morning, that's not covered by these categories on your cable system. And it may be that majority of channels are covered by these categories, it may not be that the majority of viewing is covered by these categories. In any event, there has to be some reason suggested why they did this other than to indicate to some reviewing court someday, this is what we're doing and nothing else. That they have never, in all of the briefing in this case and in all of the order, suggested any reason why Congress would have referred to those specific categories of programming if it intended to regulate all provision of service to customers, to subscribers.
I understand. Let me ask one other question. Have you thought about, in the government's brief at page 11, they sort of put down a marker for you here. Have you thought about the consequences of winning this case? That is, the risk of winning this case. Because apparently the commission has prohibited telecommunications carriers, your competitors, from entering into contracts with residential MTE owners because they have also done this. And that if this were to be vacated, the parity, the regulatory parity upon which they relied for that purpose would be eliminated, and we'd have to vacate the rule that helps you.
My understanding of that was it was commercial telephone that they had done that as to that, Your Honor. It does say residential here, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. You know more about this than I do, so I'll ask you. But
I actually may not. But there's obviously been a lot of movements over the years to try to get competition into the telephone, local telephone.
They have this quotation at the end, which I thought was they were throwing down a little warning for you of the consequence of victory. That is, the commission concluded in that order, which helped your clients, that, quote, in an environment of increasingly competitive bundled service offerings, the importance of regulatory parity is particularly compelling in our determination to remove this impediment to fair competition. Now, if we were to eliminate that regulatory parity, the underpinnings of the rule that prohibited telecommunications carriers from entering into exclusive contracts would be eliminated. That seems awfully risky, and I just wonder how this could be distinguished.
Well, we're moving into a world where people are providing all three of the services at the same time, and basically what my client's view is in that world, they think that it is healthy and better to have competition building by building as well as customer by customer in terms of what service you will provide, and that ends up actually benefiting not only the companies but also the customers that will get lower prices, better service. The buildings will get wired, which might not otherwise get wired at all for this triple play service. And so it's a risk we're willing to take, Your Honor, and that's why we're here.
Thank you.
No, thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the Court, my name is Matthew Ames, and I represent the apartment industry. As Mr. Smith said, I'm going to address the other arbitrary and capricious arguments. And we believe that the order is arbitrary and capricious basically for two reasons. First, it's based on a distorted presentation of the record. And secondly, because it departed from the FCC's past judgments in this area, principally the 2003 order, without justification. These issues are intertwined, and so I'm going to address this primarily in the context of the deviation from the 2003 order and address other issues as I go along.
May I start you with my order might be a little different than yours. I want to go right to the end of your brief on page 59. You apparently object to the fact the commission did not take into account your suggestions. The commission considers steps to promote installation of advanced wiring system by property owners so that owners can install systems that can be used by multiple providers.
Correct, Your Honor.
Explain that a little bit to me, and then I want to ask you some questions about it, because the wiring problem bothered me a little bit. I wasn't sure I understood it completely.
Okay.
What happens, for instance, in a single house when a cable company puts in a wire? Who owns the wire?
Well, there's really sort of a separate process in the single family context. I mean, the commission has a rule governing the disposition of inside wiring in a home.
I saw that mentioned in the brief. And what is it?
The rule provides that upon notice that the resident is terminating service, the cable operator basically has a choice of abandoning the wire or offering to sell the wire. And if it doesn't exercise that right offer to sell the wire, then it's basically deemed abandoned and it no longer has a claim to the wire inside the residence.
But the cable company can insist on the house owner paying for the wiring.
In the first instance, at that time, yes. Now, as a practical matter, this never happens, but that's what the rule provides for.
If it's a practical matter, they walk away.
Right.
Okay, all right. But now, what would have been the notion that, what could the FCC do to promote installation of advanced wiring system by property owners so that they could be used by multiple providers?
Your Honor, what we were trying to address in that section and really throughout the comments.
I just want to get an idea what that would be.
No. The commission had been dealing for a long time, going back to 1997, with this issue of access to wiring. In fact, the rule that we just talked about originated because of that problem. And then the commission recognized that there was an issue with access to apartment buildings. And what we were trying to do was put forward the idea to the commission that this issue of dealing with exclusive contracts was really part of a much broader problem, and that there were things that could conceivably be done to deal with
What could be done to promote installation of advanced wiring system by property owners?
Well, for example, one of the issues that we discussed in our comments before the commission was this issue of cost allocation. There are property owners who are making the investment in wiring that's capable of serving multiple providers. I mean, there's a part of their business plan. They are doing
so
that.
What could the FCC have done?
Well, they could have examined the issue from a broader context.
Yes, give me a specific. What regulation would they have issued that would have helped?
Well, we didn't get to that level of detail, Your Honor.
You know what troubles me about this? This sounds totally inconsistent with your major argument that the FCC was engaged in the regulation of property owners' rights, because your suggestion would have gone even further, bringing the FCC into regulation of apartments. So it's sort of strange.
Well, we were raising the possibility of having a discussion about what might be practical.
Raising a possibility that you or your brief would have thought is illegal.
Well, we were discussing it in a broader context. We weren't talking about Section 628. We were trying to get to the policy issue that we thought the commission was wrestling with and being open to having a discussion with them. I see your point. But we were open to the possibility that it might have played out in a different way.
In other words, you wouldn't mind if they regulated illegally if it helped you.
Well, no, Your Honor, that's not what we're saying. I mean, the property industry is very concerned about access to property. We were open to a discussion about, for example, if there were a regulation that in some way encouraged property owners to construct facilities that was open to anybody, that might be beneficial to both the property owners and to on a policy level. We would certainly oppose a rule that would demand access at the federal level for any provider. We would have a problem with that, and we don't think the commission has the authority to do that.
They haven't done it, have they?
And they have not done that. We would be opposed to that, but the concept of a network inside a building that multiple providers could use would be beneficial.
I thought you just specifically said you'd like that. You'd like a rule that required any provider to have access.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I'm clearly not being clear. We would not want the FCC to mandate that.
That's inconsistent with what you said at page 59, isn't it?
Well, we clearly didn't think it was, and I'm obviously not responding to your question very well. We were at least open to the possibility that there might be some mutually beneficial way of addressing the policy question. I guess that's
also consider requiring service provider to install wiring inside buildings to make such wiring available to competitors. That sort of suggested that you didn't think that wiring that was beyond the FCC's power to regulate your own wiring.
Well, that would be the provider's wiring in that case.
Yeah, but it would be in your building.
It would be in the building, and it would be subject to our consent.
Oh, you
but
didn't
once
say
it was
that.
In there, but once it was in there, then the providers, I mean, for example, the providers are wanting to get access to the building and wanting to control access to the wiring. That presents problems for us because we're not able to allow the competitors to use it. But if they had the obligation to make it available to anybody, once we allowed them in, that would be beneficial to the commission's policy goals and to the residents of the building.
I ask you about your reversal of course argument. Your argument, I take it, is that the record looks the same, and they've evaluated it differently, and they can't do that. Is that right?
I think it's
more than that.
I think it's more than that. I mean,
in what way?
It's certainly true that the points that we made in the rulemaking. Were the same, essentially the same points that had made before, and I think that the cable industry had done that. But we think that that the commission went beyond that in terms of its treatment of the record.
Before the commission looked at the record, leave aside the commission's argument that the record is better from their point of view. Assume it's even just the same as it was before. And before they thought that there were benefits to the way it was, and that the consequences of these kind of exclusive dealing agreements weren't so bad, but now they've thought about it, and now they think that the consequences are bad. They allow lockups, and they prevent true competition by new entrants like telephone companies. Can't they change their mind about that? On the same record, can't they just say, okay, we've looked at the same record, but we actually think that balancing the interests here, we think that that this is more pro-competitive in our opinion?
I suppose that they have the discretion to do that. Our problem is that the way they did not show that that either the record was different or that they had a reason based on the same record to reach a different conclusion. They were actually saying things were different in some ways, and that's part of the issue that we have.
Well, can't they evaluate? I mean, we're in what in antitrust would be a rule of reason territory. Can't they just evaluate themselves the competitive consequences differently than they did before? Give me a hypothetical. So the previous administration, on whatever the scientific facts are about global warming, believed that it wasn't sufficient from their point of view to regulate global warming. The Obama administration comes in and says, okay, the facts are the same. Whatever the facts are, but we actually think global warming is important and we're going to regulate global warming. Is it not possible for a new administration to come in and say, even on the same facts, that we evaluate things differently?
Sure.
Be honest
about
that, not to say, you know, we're going to make up different facts or something. They just come in. Isn't that what was basically what Chevron was about? Isn't that what I think Justice Rehnquist's separate opinion in State Farm was about, that a new administration or a new group of commissioners or even the same political body, the executive body, can change its mind about what's important from the same set of facts?
They can change their mind, but they still have to provide a reasoned analysis. And we think that the way they handle the record is not a demonstration that there's a reasoned analysis.
What specifically?
Well, for example, in 2003, one of the important factors was that, and actually going back to 1997, that exclusive agreements allow owners to ensure better service and amenities for residents, among other things. Now, in 2007, the commission expressly reversed that judgment. They said, looking at the record that we have now, We don't think that these benefits are there. Now, if we look specifically at the record,
but they said it's the balance, that they regarded the balance as different. Not that there are no benefits. I thought that they say, don't they end up by saying?
Well, no, that's fair enough, Your Honor. Fair enough, Your Honor. That's a fair point. But when you look at the basis for their judgment, at the core of that basis is their conclusion that, in fact, owners don't have good reasons for signing exclusive agreements. And that's essentially one of their findings. Now, in 2003, the FCC said that, yes, owners do have good reasons. This time around, they said, no, they don't. Now, our objection to that is that we submitted extensive comments explaining why we believe that there are good reasons, and we feel that those comments were not sufficiently addressed and, in fact, distorted. The commission,
which specific comment do you think was inadequately addressed?
The commission, we made the point that there's a cost allocation function to these agreements.
That's they didn't use that phrase.
No, that's true. But
they
part of that
the
argument.
Concept, but they responded to the concept, isn't it?
No, that's not entirely. They responded to part of the concept. They responded to the concept providers benefit from exclusivity. One of the points that we had made was that the property owners who make investments in inside wiring themselves, because there are property owners who put in advanced systems and then try to recover some of that cost from the operator, that's beneficial to them to be able to recover that cost. And that concept was not addressed at all by the commission. Another issue that we have with the treatment of the record is this concept that which they say several times.
Incidentally, didn't they specifically indicate you could perhaps they didn't. You could charge access fees to multiple cable providers, couldn't you, as an apartment owner?
Well, they didn't address that. Theoretically, we could, but as a practical matter, exclusivity has value. And one of the concerns that property owners.
An exclusive agreement is more valuable than multiple access agreements.
That's correct. And property owners feel that they're not going to be able to recover their costs if they don't have exclusivity to sell. Another aspect of the commission's treatment of the record is this concept that owners sign agreements not knowing what's in them. The FCC talks about signing operators.
Some.
Fair enough, Your Honor, but I would say some. How many is some? And the concept that people in the property business don't know what they're signing or sign things without knowing them is a little bit hard to accept. Again, particularly in the face of all the evidence that we put in, it'd be one thing for them to say that and then go through some kind of analysis where they looked at what we had to say and say, on balance, this is where we come out. But they didn't do that. And
they had to do a survey to see how many apartment owners were smart enough to retain adequate counsel to think about that.
I think it's a matter of common sense, Your Honor, that property owners know what they're signing. I mean, the question that I have for the commission is, why sign if there are no benefits? It doesn't make any sense for a property owner.
I acknowledge that there are benefits to the what is that? I can never remember acronyms. MD something or other. The apartment owners.
The MDUs, multiple dwelling unit owners.
I mean, they acknowledge there are benefits to them.
Well, they essentially reversed their position between 2000 and 2007.
True. Isn't the key real difference the emergence of the triple play option?
Actually, I didn't. No, we don't think so, Your Honor. And the reason for that is that the 2003 order.
In terms of the FCC's thinking.
Well, in terms of their thinking, well, it may be in terms
they
of their
say
thinking.
It. They say it.
But and I think we just think they're wrong about that.
That's a policy call.
In the 2003 order, the commission talks about triple play. It's clear that both the private cable operators and the franchise cable operators were making investments.
Yeah, but it's very different now. 7 years later, it was totally different. There was much more of it.
There is more of it now. In fact, that's one of our points, is that with exclusives in the market, there is more triple play service being provided both by the franchise cable operators, by the SMATVs, the non-franchise cable operators, even before the phone companies.
The commission's position is that if this MDU market was opened up, there'd be even more of it. That's their point.
And again.
That's their point.
I guess our response to that is simply I guess it's twofold. One is that the market was advancing anyway, and as the numbers show, the cable, the share
outside of the MDUs.
Well, that's across the board. The market is more competitive.
Yeah, but the commission found it less competitive in the category of areas covered by MDUs.
Except that they have no actual – there's no actual evidence of that in the record. That's pure supposition on their part. There are no numbers. There's no penetration levels. There's no discussion of any variance between in-buildings and out-buildings in the record.
Just on the basic competition question, was it not true that when the rule was originally decided, cable operators were really the only ones who were able to provide this kind of programming, and that at the time this new rule came out, the phone companies were now capable of providing it? Or at least that they were more and advertising it more and everything else?
I don't think so. Not if I understand your question correctly, Your Honor. I mean, if you go back, we cited to you the Fourth Circuit's case, Associated Satellite Resources, Continental Cablevision. We can go back to the 1970s, and we see the same dynamic that's been in place throughout this process. There have been competitors. The satellite competitors were an option. And the property owners used that as an option. If they weren't happy with the deal they got from the cable operator, they had that option. But at the same time, they were making deals with the cable operators. In that case, the issue was that the facts were that the cable operator offered a choice. You pay for the wiring and we'll serve the building, or we pay for the wiring and we want exclusivity. So this dynamic has been there throughout.
Well, let's say that there were – you're talking about SMA TV like that,
correct,
right?
Your Honor.
So there was some possible competition, but the difference between those kind of competitors and the power of the local exchange carriers is significantly different, isn't it? I mean, is it irrational for the FCC to think, look, at the time we originally didn't do anything about this, there wasn't really much to it. There's exclusivity, but there weren't very many competitors. At least there weren't any powerful competitors, so it wasn't that big a deal. But now there are powerful competitors who are being kept out, and if they weren't kept out, could drive prices down.
Well, that raises two issues, Your Honor. One is are they really being kept out, or to what extent are they being kept out? And the second is what I would call –
not being kept out, that is, if there are no exclusivity agreements, then we don't have to worry about it, right? We only have to worry about it if they are being kept out.
Well, that brings me to my second issue. If this is an issue about fairness or competition with respect to the two companies, as we discussed, that the real estate industry is discussing the comments, the phone companies actually have a very powerful ability to get into markets simply by virtue of the fact that they provide voice service, the Bell brand voice service. If they go to a property owner, particularly in the case of new construction, but if they go to a property owner and say, in fact, there's a Verizon
let me
submitted.
Just hold for one second. You said especially new construction, right? What about the existing exclusivity agreements? They can't, you have an existing exclusivity agreement, which is, say, perpetual, or for another 20 years. Nothing they can do can get them into the building.
Well, the issue of perpetual agreements was not really elaborated on in the order. If you go back to 1997, I think it was also addressed in 2003, the commission at that time examined the question of, they were considering regulating perpetual agreements. They concluded at that time, based on information that we'd provided, that perpetual agreements were less than 5% of the market. They also concluded property owners didn't like them and they weren't granting new ones. So based on that prior record, it's a very – now, Hargrave does a good job of bringing that up in this proceeding, but there are very, very few of those in the market.
Counsel, let me ask you a question, if I may interrupt for a moment. Suppose 50% of the exclusive agreements were telephone companies and 50% were cable companies. Wouldn't it still be logical for the FCC to ban, under their theory, to ban exclusive agreements?
Well, to the extent that they are anticipating or think that they're promoting multiple providers serving buildings, I suppose it would.
Right. In other words, but they're concerned about the ultimate apartment owner or apartment renter rather than the – in other words, the fact that there may be alternatives for the management of the apartment doesn't necessarily result in a sufficiently competitive market for the consumer.
That's a judgment call. And
right. So, but anyway, that's my – my point is it's perfectly – isn't it right? It's perfectly logical for them to ban exclusive agreements, whether or not whatever percentage of the market the telephone company has and whatever percentage the
That presumes two things. First, that the owners will let everybody in, and secondly, that there is that kind of parity.
No, they're not trying to – they don't regulate the owners. The owners have complete authority to refuse to allow access, but they could logically preclude exclusive agreements even if they were split 50-50 between telephone companies and cable companies, right? If they're interested in the ultimate concern.
I suppose they could, Your Honor.
So then trying to focus on how much of the market the cable companies have and how much of the telephone companies have is not really relevant.
I apologize, Your Honor. I'm not sure I'm understanding your point. One of the concerns that we had in the rulemaking was that because of this asymmetric power that I was talking about a second ago, the phone companies are actually very well placed to compete over time. As they start to get into buildings, both new construction and old construction, because they provide the brand name voice service, which still matters to a lot of people, they're in a very strong market position. And that's something that the commission didn't consider at all. Now, you know, maybe they could have considered it and come out the same way anyway, but one of our concerns is that they've not examined that as a possibility.
So is your suggestion, in a way, exactly the opposite of your argument in the brief, that what they should have prohibited is all their prohibition should have been retroactive, and they should have had no prospective? Well, right? Because they can't compete with an agreement that was made in the past and applies into the future, right? No matter how great competitors they are, if there's a 10-year agreement, if there's a 5-year agreement, if there's a 15-year agreement, they can't get into that building, right?
Well, not at the time being, not at the moment. But again, agreements expire. It's not like all these agreements are forever or that they don't roll over. And they also can't build everywhere at once. I mean, this is a dynamic market, and if the commission were to let this evolve, it would happen.
You're saying retroactivity is only a tiny problem then. Is that your point? Well, we shouldn't have to worry about retroactivity because it's only a tiny problem.
Well, we don't argue retroactivity.
Well, I thought they were giving you the advantage.
Beg your pardon?
So the way in which you've allocated the argument, retroactivity is wholly on Mr. Smith.
That's not in our – we don't argue that point in our brief.
All right.
you say in your brief that – let me just ask you about a different subject. You say in your brief that the commission here is improperly regulating the real estate industry, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
But the regulation really only applies to cable operators.
That's what the commission argues, and
isn't that accurate?
I beg your pardon?
That's what they argue. Isn't that totally accurate?
Well, this gets into the question, I guess ultimately it gets us into the question of the application, the scope of the cable and wireless case, since that's basically the...
Why isn't this case a fortiori to that case? In that case, the FCC regulated, told the domestic communications companies that they couldn't pay more to the foreign companies for transmission termination, right?
Correct.
Which was every bit in benefit of the domestic companies. They were deliberately trying to enhance the bargaining position of the domestic companies. And the foreign companies came in and said, hey, wait a minute, you're regulating us. And we said, no. We're regulating the FCC is regulating the domestic companies. Now, if that was true there, isn't this a fortiori? Because it's clear what we were trying to do, or rather the FCC was trying to do, is help the domestic companies and really pin the foreign companies.
Well, Your Honor, I think we would distinguish cable and wireless on two bases. One is that the commission's authority in that case was clearly related to the issue of foreign telecommunications and the domestic carriers, and it went right to the core of the commission's responsibilities. What we're talking about here are agreements for the use of property. And we think that's fundamentally different. This isn't even a regulation of the service that the operators provide. It's not a regulation of cable service. They're agreements for the use of property, and that's a distinction from cable and wireless in terms of the actual jurisdiction of the agency. The other concern we have with respect to cable and wireless, although we certainly accept the point of what you might call the weak form of cable and wireless, in that the commission is not responsible for identifying all of the ancillary effects that its regulations might have, The commission has already cited cable and wireless in an open docket going back a few years, the competitive networks docket, for the proposition that it can effectively mandate access to properties. This was on the telecommunications side, by regulating the incumbent carrier in a building if an office building owner were not willing to allow a competitor in. They are relying on cable and wireless for the concept that they could tell the phone company, you can't serve that building under our authority under 201 and cable and wireless. And it's clear, even from the context at that time, that they're really trying to get the property owner to open up its property. So we're concerned about the possibility of that there's a line there where cable and wireless goes too far.
We've taken you well over your time.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor. Thanks very much.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I'm Joel Marcus for the FCC. I have just a few points to make, starting with the statutory arguments raised by Mr. Smith. I think that closer to home than the Oncali case, which I agree with you, Judge Garland is controlling here, the consumer electronics case, which is reported at 347 F3rd 291, is also, I think, directly on point on the issues that they're raising. There, consumer group was raising the argument that the FCC couldn't regulate digital receivers because Congress had a specific motive in enacting the statute under which the commission was acting, and that specific motive for enacting the statute didn't include the regulation of digital receivers. The court, at page 297 of its opinion, said, the objection is that the commission relies almost entirely on a literal reading of the statutory language, and that's not the most damning criticism when it comes to statutory interpretation. And I think the court is right on track here when it points to the literal language of the statute, which in this case I think unquestionably authorizes the FCC to do what it did here. I'll point out in that regard, Judge Tatel, in response to your question, that at paragraph 4 of the commission's order, and this is at JA 797, the commission entered a finding that the substantial majority of the programming is satellite-delivered cable programming. I don't think that it's possible to put a number on it because it could vary from system to system, but it's clear that what's being prevented here is essentially the bulk of programming that you see on cable television. Now, Mr.
What did you say about the argument that counsel presented in the brief that they really didn't hammer today in the oral argument, which is that there's a sharp distinction between programming and service in the definitions of the statute? And if Congress had intended your interpretation, they would have used the word service rather than programming.
Well, you have to keep in mind that the definition of service is the provision of programming. So the two of them are intimately linked to each other, Judge Silberman. And I think that there's no question here that Congress had a particular motive in enacting this statute, and the motive was making sure that basically Time Warner didn't keep somebody else from getting HBO, if I could reduce it to the clearest example. And so if they had said cable service in Section B of the statute, then Time Warner could have said, well, we withheld HBO, but they can provide cable service. We're not interfering with that. And I think what we have here then is exactly what the consumer electronics case was talking about. We have a statute that was enacted with a particular motive, and I think it has some oddities in the statutory language that were driven by the motive that Congress had in mind. But Congress seems to have deliberately chosen broader language. If it was restricted to the provision of programming on the wholesale level, Judge Silberman, I see no reason why Congress would have written a statute that says it shall be unlawful for a cable operator to engage in practices, the effect of which is to hinder the provision of programming to customers. Congress clearly had a broader focus as a whole, and I think that this goes back to the context of this statute and the overall thrust of the entire 92 Cable Act. If you look at the statute itself, Section 628, is entitled Development of Competition and Diversity in Video Programming Distribution. From its very title, it's not saying protection of wholesale programming markets. It's talking about a much more broad competitive focus. It then goes into purposes for the statute in Section A. The purpose of this section is to increase competition and diversity in the market, to spur the development of communications technologies. Congress wanted another wire provider in there. It wanted DBS providers in there. It wanted greater competition. It wanted more people in the market. And
I'm confused by your emphasizing that part of the purpose rather than the balance of the section, which seems more to your point. Purpose to increase the availability of satellite cable programming and satellite broadcasting programming to persons in rural and other areas.
Oh, absolutely.
And therefore, not to vendors, therefore not to distributors.
I think that's absolutely right, Judge
Gorsuch. But to persons, meaning to the end user.
Well, again, you're right. Congress is focusing again on the end user as it did in subsection B.
You make an argument in your brief that even if we didn't agree with your statutory interpretation argument as a slam dunk, you're entitled to Chevron deference.
Well, I think, Judge Silberman, if I could...
You do make that argument, right?
Yes, we do. And I...
Tell me, if we reach that point, where would you describe the ambiguity to which you're entitled to deferential interpretation?
I think there's a difference here between the plain language of the statute and perhaps the plain meaning of the statute. The statute does not say in terms, thou shalt regulate MDU access agreements. And so to that degree, it does not directly address the specific issue that we have before us, right, you know, that the commission had and that now you have. The Congress spoke more broadly, and I think that it gave the commission substantial room for interpretation. So if you look, for example, at Section C of the statute, it says the commission shall make regulations to increase competition and diversity in the video programming market. And so, in other words, what the commission said was, yes, this plain language empowers us to do this.
No,
I think that's a Chevron 2 argument.
The Chevron 2 argument is on B?
I think that there's a Chevron 2 argument on B, but it's an extraordinarily powerful Chevron 2 argument. In other words, the Congress did not specifically say regulate MDU exclusivity, but it did.
It
did not say regulate MDU exclusive contracts, but it did use language that seems to plainly cover MDU exclusive
That's
contracts.
That's funny. The language plainly covers, but you're entitled to deference as to the interpretation of an ambiguity.
Well, you know, I mean, the ambiguity is only in that.
How about the word programming? Is that an ambiguity, an ambiguous term?
I don't think so, because.
Well, Mr. Marcus, isn't your opponent's argument is, as is just expressed here, is that while Section B may be plain language in your favor, if you continue in the Chevron 1 look at the entire context of the statute, it's the context that introduces ambiguity. So if we accept the argument of your opponent that it is the context that introduces ambiguity, then your answer under Chevron would be all right. If that's true, then you have to give us Chevron 2 deference to evaluation of the context. So when Part C 2 talks about the specific kinds of regulations, you should give us deference because that talks about minimum. And just because a bunch of specific ones don't cover our situation, it's ambiguous. It seems like to the extent there is a ambiguity question, it's raised by your opponent's argument about context, not about specific language.
Well, I think that—
Is there any reason why Chevron 2 wouldn't apply to that kind of ambiguity?
Oh, absolutely not. Absolutely
Well, you're going to accept Chevron 2 whenever it's offered.
Well, I think that's right. As a general matter, Judge Silberman, in the same way that we'll get to this later, but in the same way that the commission has the opportunity.
I didn't really think C was all that ambiguous either. It just simply states specifically what you're required to issue regulations. It doesn't preclude regulations on other matters.
I completely agree with you. There are degrees of ambiguity, and there's much here.
Are you completely agreeing that interpretation is reasonable or that looking at B and C together, it's unambiguous?
I agree that I understood what Judge Silberman was saying was that...
No, I was asking you a question. I heard what Judge Silberman asked. My question is, I thought the commission's position was that notwithstanding the differences between B and C, when you read them together, it's unambiguous.
I think that the commission's position is that it's plain what Congress authorized us to do. There may be – Congress did not have a specific
– So do we have to get to any question of whether or not the commission's interpretation is reasonable?
Well, you don't need to reach that.
You're happy to win on step one.
I'm happy to win on step one. I'm saying that I don't think I don't think the commission –
I was wondering whether you were abandoning that position in your answers to Judge Silberman's question.
I'm not abandoning a plain language argument here. I think that the plain language is highly relevant to a Chevron step two interpretation. And I think that, as I said a moment ago, there are degrees of ambiguity. I think there's very little ambiguity here, but Congress did not specifically say, thou shalt regulate MDU exclusivity. And so therefore, it didn't directly address the very issue that we have before us, and I think that leaves a little play in the joints.
Address, then you're under Chevron. You're in Chevron step two.
Yeah.
You automatically, if you concede Congress did not directly address the issue, bango, you're in
right,
Chevron
and
step two.
Right, and I believe that we are at step two here. Although, if the court
do now, now I'm really confused.
Me too.
So you think it's a Chevron two case?
Well, I
thought your position was that Congress did in B specifically address the question here. Maybe not the specifics of these particular units, but it directly addressed the question of the commission's power to do what it did here.
I think that
was your position.
I think that it, looking at the...
Because if your position is that it, since it didn't address MDUs or into Chevron 2, that's not the way I read your brief.
Okay. Well, I think that our position is that the plain language of the statute... and this is, I'm reading from paragraph 43 of the order here. This is a JA 815. And the commission wrote, the plain language of section 628B encompasses the conduct at issue here. That is not that the plain language compels the action that we are taking, but rather it gives us the authority to do what we're doing here.
Could you have interpreted this statute the contrary?
I believe so. You know, if I were standing up here with somebody else on the other side and the commission had decided that this did not cover this, I think that that is a conceivable outcome to me. I think I'd have an uphill battle. But, again, that's the very nature of Chevron, is that it can conceivably go either way.
Fair point. I want to shift you to a different concern I have on the arbitrary and capricious nature or alleged nature of your ruling. You quite powerfully pointed out that certain states do provide barriers to exclusivity agreements.
That's correct.
How many states do?
I think it's 18.
So 18. Your regulation really has effect only, practical
on
effect only in the
32
balance states. Yes. Is that correct?
Presumably so. I mean, I haven't read each one of those states' laws. I don't know. They could be different in some respect or another, but
now,
generally
speaking. You put the argument in the reverse in your brief, but it occurred to me to ask the question, well, what about the markets in those states? Isn't there any indication, if you were right, there would be an indication that prices for cable service in the states where exclusivity agreements are permitted would be higher than in states where they're banned.
Well,
but you have no evidence to that effect.
In
fact, you turned it around and said, well, the petitioners don't have any evidence to the contrary.
Well, I think that what's part of what's going on here is that this is an emerging market. Just because a state passes a non-exclusivity provision doesn't mean that the next day there is competitive service available. You know, it takes years to build these things out. My understanding...
Is there a big gap in your regulation and there's no indication as to how these markets behave? You have a perfect testing vehicle
Well, that's not entirely...
And you didn't even look at it.
That's not entirely true, Judge Silberman.
Which part?
Well, that we have no idea how these markets behave. I think that
the comparing the state the 18 states with the 32.
I understand that, but the point is that in those 18 states, it doesn't necessarily mean that there's actual competition going on. It just means that those states have laid the groundwork for fair competition. It takes many years to build out a competitive cable system. And I think the relevant data point here is found in footnote 52 of the order, which is at page 804 of the joint appendix. And the commission had found that prices are 17% lower where wireline competition is present. And that's a hard data point. In other words, you got two people going head-to-head, prices are lower. That doesn't happen, by the way, with the satellite competition.
I was about to ask you about that.
Right. And the commission has found that. And so that's the relevant data point here, because the commission is trying to foster an environment where competitors can come into the market. But if there's an exclusive...
Wouldn't a regulation be better if they compared the states in which they banned...
I suppose that if we had perfect data available to us all the time, we would love to have that.
This is good enough for government work.
Well, you know, I certainly think that we have amply justified this under the APA.
With respect to the real estate operations and the owners, isn't there a big difference between apartment owners on the one hand and condominium and cooperative structures on the other, particularly with the suggestion that the apartment owners might have a different interest than the apartment dwellers?
That may or may not be. If you've ever been on a co-op board and somebody has complained
my wife owns a condominium, yes.
Okay.
I have watched how they work. It does seem to me that most the ones I've seen, the condominium owners are very active managers.
Right,
in fact, so active they can drive everybody nuts.
Well, that's kind of the point.
We're not going to name that particular.
There's a board and it makes decisions.
But you're talking about generally rather affluent people. They know what they're doing.
I'm not sure I totally agree with you on the not know what they're doing. There's a delegation to the board. Figure out what's going on with the telecom, and that doesn't mean that every resident in that building is going to be satisfied with the decision.
Well, the residents care very much who's going to be coming into the building, don't they? They care much. Care very much about that.
Some do, some don't. But I think what the commission remember, the building can always exclude anybody that it wants to exclude. So if the residents decide,
my question, I have to confess to you, was not raised by. Petition. So
that's true.
It just reflects only my own interest. It wouldn't be a matter I could legitimately rely on because the petitioners didn't draw that distinction.
But I think your
they
question
did make the argument it should be case by case, and your argument against that was that would in that direction lies bureaucratic insanity.
I think that it would drive us into the ground, Judge Silberman. But I think that your question though did raise an important policy point here, which is that the commission decided, as a policy matter essentially, that individuals should have the choice of competitors and that some deal between a cable incumbent, you know, essentially monopolist cable company and a developer or a building manager or even a co-op board should not deprive an individual of the opportunity to select competitive carriers, and that is very much at the core of 628 itself, of the 1992 Cable Act as a whole, and of the overall thrust of the public policy direction that the commission has been taking. The idea is to increase competition, to remove barriers to entry, and that's exactly what's done here. And so I think that unless the court has any further questions on any of the points that have been raised, the commission is on very solid ground.
One other question. Does the cable company have, even if there's no exclusivity clause allowed in the contract, does the cable company have any legal right to get their wiring back or the cost of the wiring on a quantum merit basis?
There are these complex inside wiring rules that Mr. Ames was addressing, and if somebody terminates service,
the cable company does, it's required to offer to sell the wire to an individual homeowner, or what's called the home wiring, which is the part that goes into your individual apartment, to a condo owner, let's say, at basically at the cost of the wire, whatever that is, 12 cents a foot. There's also wiring in a large apartment building that's called home run wiring, and that's essentially the wire that goes up the stairway. And in that, in the home run wiring context, they're required to engage in negotiations with the building over the disposition of that wiring. They don't have an absolute right to remove their wiring. There has to be some bargaining process. If at the end the parties can't reach an agreement, the cable company has a right to remove the wiring and, you know, effectively remediate the building. But so if they're going to have to, you know, send in workmen and tear down walls and then patch them up and what have you, as a practical matter, I think, as Mr. Ames was saying, people just walk away from this stuff because it's just too expensive to take it out.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. So, we ask that the court affirm the commission's order in all respects.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Andrew McBride on behalf of the respondent interveners, AT&T et al. First of all, the respondents take no position on the continuing vitality of Justice Blackmun's opinion in Holy Trinity. But we would point out that in that particular case, it was a constitutional issue that motivated the court to, some would say, significantly change the literal terms of the statute.
Although it's been used in various cases in statutory interpretation.
But here, I think,
most notably by Justice Brennan, you may recall.
Actually, I don't have that one right at hand. But what I would say is that here the key part of the statute is the words Congress used in B, the unfair methods of competition or unfair deceptive acts or practices, and then the delegation to the agency to define those terms. That simply can't be reconciled with this statute going after the one narrow goal, because essentially the agency at that point would have nothing to do but parrot the statutory prohibition. And here the agency was given broad authority, and that authority clearly runs up and down the distributional chain. I mean, there really isn't a great deal of difference between a cable operator inducing its affiliate not to sell programming and a cable operator inducing a third party between it and the customer to stop competitive programming from reaching the customer.
So is this a Chevron 1 case?
You know, I was thinking about that, obviously, as
the
debate was going on. Well, Chief Judge Roberts' opinion in Consumer Electronics, which I think is on all fours, what he said is the burden lies over here to show it's Chevron 1 that the agency can't do it. So he really doesn't have to get into whether it's Chevron 1, Chevron 2. These guys have to prove that it is Chevron 1, the agency can't do it, which obviously the text alone precludes here. And once you decide that, Chevron 2 is over as well. Really, the case is over once you decide that the commission has authority under this statute.
But do we have to decide between Chevron 1 and Chevron 2? Could we not say, even if it were ambiguous, since the plain language fits, this is a reasonable interpretation?
That depends on how you read Consumer Electronics, because there is the possibility left open by then-Judge Roberts in his opinion that legislative history could create an ambiguity that would require a Chevron 2 analysis of even a statute that literally authorized the agency. Now,
what I'm asking is, what you're saying is it could require Chevron 2 analysis. What I'm asking is, couldn't we decide this on Chevron 2, say?
Absolutely.
Even if there are ambiguities created by legislative history or by anything else, it's reasonable to interpret the statute according to its words.
Most definitely. I mean, you have the statutory language itself. The context is really the 92 Cable Act, and that context is some of the most scathing findings Congress has ever made about an industry and about its monopoly practices. That's the context in which the court has to situate this particular provision. And then the legislative history is exactly the same as Consumer Electronics. It just says, we're really concerned about this. But you would need in that legislative history a plain statement that said, we're concerned about this and nothing else, and the agency may do nothing else.
Your point is that there's no legislative history that draws a boundary above which the FCC cannot move. There's no boundary line.
In fact, the opposite, Judge Silberman, because page 17 of the intervener's brief, you'll see the so-called Manton Amendment, which was something very similar to what the cable operators want to twist this statute into. And it's about two sentences long, and it says that programming distribution agreements can't be exclusive. That's the core of it, nothing else. That's not what Congress did. It did something else, and it clearly thought the agency was going to have some work to do in the future under fairly general language. A couple of points on the record. One, Mr. Ames represents the landlord community, but there are comments in the record the commission was entitled to take into account. JA 735, Palmetto Dunes Property Association, saying, we're against these agreements, and we think that our building is more attractive to consumers if we can say, you choose your own cable company. And that goes to the economic debate here, where Judge Silberman basically asked, in a perfect market, wouldn't this be okay?
But isn't that just their argument is they should leave it to each individual building to decide what's economically best for us?
The fact
that some don't want exclusive agreements doesn't mean that economically it's not better for others to have them.
But the commission can certainly decide that in its view there is a disjunction between the landlord or the builder and the individual consumers, and that there will be more technology, more expansion of competition if each individual consumer can make that decision. Sometimes the builder in the Hargray situation, a builder would sign these in the 70s. They're still in effect. And often what the cable companies will do is, as Verizon announces, as you said, Judge Garland, on the television, you know, that Fios is coming, they'll start locking people up. They'll say, we'll give the MDU owner whatever benefits, you know, bennies, goodies, and we'll lock up this, 500-unit building before Verizon gets here. It's not like they don't know we're coming. And so that dynamic is very different from 2003. In essence, in 2003, you had a trickle of competition, and the commission said, these don't matter. Now, you have real competition, and they do matter because there are big gaps in service territories, and they create disincentives to enhance your facilities to serve those service territories. Sometimes they just snap up on you. You start to wire an area, and you start to try and serve, and then all of a sudden, bang, the cable company says, no, that building is off limits after you've made the capital investment. That is the kind of thing that stops competition, that stops the technological advancement that's mentioned in the purpose of the statute. For those reasons, we would ask that the petitions for review be denied.
Does Mr. Smith have any time left? Okay, you can take 2 minutes, if you'd like it.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a couple of comments starting off, if I could, about the retroactivity argument. The reason why we're the only petitioners raising that is that if the clauses are excised from the agreements, the apartment building owners will continue to have all the benefits of those agreements, any concessions they won, all the wires that are there, and it'll just be the consideration that was given to the cable companies that will be taken out. That's the problem that the FCC refused to grapple with by when they said there wasn't any expectation that these things would be allowed into the future. I also want to note that on the severability clause issue, as discussed in footnote 112 of paragraph 37 on JA 813, and it's very clear if you look at those, they're just generic severability clauses that don't betray any anticipation of this order back in the years before 2007. And as to the problem of perpetual agreements, to the extent there really are any out there, clearly the FCC could have done something to say to cap these things at 5 years, but it's a different thing altogether to completely eliminate your ability to recapture your investment, especially without even weighing the harms and the benefits.
Do we think... Do you have some idea of how long is left on these? We're only asking about the retroactivity question. How long is left?
Well, there's hundreds and thousands of different agreements, Your Honor. I think that the evidence shows that the average one is three to five years long, and that we're largely talking about either some very long-term ones that could have been capped or a lot of them that have been entered into in just the last 4 or 5 years in reliance on the commission's authorization, essentially. Some of them the investment will not be recouped precisely because the FCC said we're not going to make this prospective, which they clearly could have, and they didn't really weigh the facts. On the statutory issue, I still haven't heard any explanation about why Congress would have used the language satellite programming if it was intending to authorize regulation of service in general. And in the absence of that, we think it's a Chevron step one case and that we win. That's how we look at the case, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted.